Good morning. Please come to order. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judges Jessen, Larkin, and Riley, the Honorable Lucinda E. Jessen presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals here on September 10th, because we're conducting oral arguments versus Zoom.gov. Our first case is State versus Christopher Michael Wendt, A19-0200. See that both counsels are present. Though we are doing this via Zoom, our regular rules apply. So each party will get 15 minutes for their argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Our marshal will be holding up a clock or a phone on his computer so that you'll be able to, and we all will be able to track the time. We will have questions as we normally would. And so we may interrupt you, we may wave our hand to capture your attention. Please be alert with that. And if you have any technological problems, let us know. So we'll stop the time and time and get those addressed. So with that, counsel for appellant, when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. And can you hear me okay?
Yes.
May it please the court, Mr. Griffin. My name is Adam Johnson. I represent the appellant, Christopher Michael Wendt, in this case. This is an appeal that largely consists of the trial process, the fairness and the rights that attend to a criminal defendant in a criminal trial. In large part, it's a prosecutorial misconduct case, and I would urge the court at the outset to really look at that issue. I do believe that that issue is sufficient to warrant a reversal of his conviction without even getting to anything else. There's a, I would say, rather unique issue due to the standard of review with regard to alleged official conduct during the course of the trial. That's what spurned the post-conviction evidentiary hearing, because there weren't facts developed at the time. There now are. There's also an issue with regard to a jury instruction. And all of these issues come together cumulatively and require a reversal of Mr. Wendt's conviction. I urge the court, however, inclined to do so, simply rule on the prosecutorial misconduct, because there are more than sufficient bases to reverse on the prosecutorial misconduct alone. I'm not suggesting that this is the most egregious case in Minnesota history. Prosecutorial misconduct cases, I would say, fall on a spectrum. On one end, you probably have the close call, reverses, and this is, I'm talking about reversible cases. At the other end of the spectrum, you may have a case where the prosecutor was relying on somebody's ethnicity or country of origin is clearly required to be reversed. This probably falls somewhere in the middle, but nonetheless does require a reversal.
Mr. Johnson, this is Judge Riley. Can you hear me?
I can, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Griffin in his brief said that the main issue at trial was whether or not your client was driving negligently. Do you think that was the crux of the issue at trial?
I do think so. I did not participate in the trial, but from my review of the record, I do think, based on the way that the defense strategy was pursued, how cross-examination was conducted, and how oral argument was provided, that the issue of negligence was primary to Mr. Wendt's defense.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Johnson, if I can follow up on that, I understand that there were errors here, and I think there's admitted, conceded by the state, and there were some plain errors here, including with the, probably with the jury instruction, but when it comes down to it, he had meth in his system, and he admitted he drifted on the right shoulder as he merged. You know, why isn't that just those facts, which are uncontested, I understand it, why isn't that enough to say that's enough to support this, you know, this verdict despite several errors?
Well, number one, I think that from my review of the record, the evidence surrounding the issue of negligence was contested. I don't think that it was established beyond all doubt at the outset or through the course of the trial that nobody could differ with regard to an ultimate conclusion with regard to the existence of negligence, especially given the abundance of driving conduct favorable to Mr. Wendt that was provided during the courts of the evidentiary phase of the trial and then in his counsel's argument. So I don't think this is a case where we have overwhelming evidence of guilt and all of the errors sort of fall to the side. This really is a case where, from my review of the record, it could have gone either way. The jury never was really in a position to look at the evidence as they should have been able to look at it without the impact of the prosecutor's statements throughout the trial and then in closing argument. From my position, the jury must have been overwhelmed by that rebuttal argument. It had nothing to do with the evidence. It had everything to do with inferences to be drawn about Mr. Wendt's bad character, strategy, his defense counsel strategy, et cetera, as I've read.
So, Mr. Johnson, what about, it seemed to me clear from that reading the testimony from the accident reconstruction expert, I forget the name, that there was no evidence that the Camaro was in the lane of traffic. I mean, when you kind of put that this is where I'm struggling, because I understand some of your points about what the prosecutor said in crossing the line. But when you put that evidence with his admission that he may have or weaved into the outside lane, why in the world isn't that enough? That seems pretty close to overwhelming to me.
I think that's one piece of the evidence. I also think that Nicole Bonnet Berg testified that Mr. Wendt was in the far right lane, not the shoulder. What the other witness said, and from her observation of the traffic accident, there was a diagram that was presented by one of the troopers and testified to, indicating that the Camaro may have been sticking out into the lane of traffic. And as soon as you have that evidence, I think you have a reasonable question as to causation and the degree to which Mr. Wendt's negligence considered in relation to potential negligence by the other driver. And so when you have those facts, I think we get beyond sort of the uncontested case scenario that might otherwise exist without those facts. Hope I'm answering the question to your satisfaction, but that would be my position with regard to your question.
Thank you.
I do want to talk just briefly about the jury instruction, because I do think that that's related to what we've already been talking about. The courts have been, I think, clear at this point that suggesting or expressing an order in which a superior offense and an inferior offense or lesser included offense are to be considered as improper and plain error in the post-conviction court, although this court's not bound by the district court's order on that issue, did reach the conclusion that that was plain error, but ultimately decided the jury was free to consider the elements, notwithstanding the suggestion or expression of that order. And in any event, the district court provided other protective instructions that mitigated the prejudice from that order. And I just don't see that borne out in the record. And I don't see that borne out in the jury's decision. The district court at the same time concluded that the jury clearly did not consider the lesser included offense because of the expression of an order provided, only to consider the lesser included offense if you find the defendant not guilty on the greater offense.
So, Mr. Johnson, just so that I understand what you're saying, I mean, it isn't kind of our analysis of that, especially after the Woodward case, kind of whether the kind of that no rational jury would have acquitted the defendant of the more serious charge. And isn't that, I just want your perspective on that, basically the same question that we face when we talk about some of these other, you know, a couple of the things like we know he is a liar statement where we move to look at, did that error affect your client's substantial rights? I mean, would you agree those are basically the same analysis?
I would. I think that they both involve that step. You know, in State versus Dahlin, the court said that noting that a part of the jury deliberations is the jury evaluating whether a lesser included crime is more appropriate than the greater crime is important. And in this case, the jury did not even have the opportunity to do that. Now, that's sort of the threshold question. And then we get to the prejudice question or whether substantial rights were violated. And I think it's clear that they were. And I think that that's an inescapable conclusion when you consider all of the other errors that exist in this case. he just did not receive a fair trial at the end of the day. I steadfast in the belief that the jury's will was overborne in some capacity. And perhaps they, on retrial, come to the same conclusion, but we don't have these defects in the trial mechanism. That's my urge for reversal. I would note we submitted in the parties over 120 pages of briefing. I know it's been briefed. Things have probably, from my position, have been stated more than once, perhaps, but if the court doesn't have any other questions, I would...
Mr. Johnson, I have a question. Judge Meyer put out or wrote a really lengthy order for the post-conviction relief motion that you brought, and she made extensive findings of fact in that order. I assume, and I just want to make sure that I'm clear, you don't dispute the facts that she found. It's just the legal analysis that she applied to those facts. Is that correct?
That would be correct, Your Honor. I'm not, your question's not triggering in my mind a concern from the appellant's perspective with regard to findings that were made in that order. I would note that although the findings are lengthy, the findings on the judicial conduct that's been alleged are rather sparse and are contained in the argument. There aren't really any findings of fact on that issue, and that was the primary evidentiary reason for going into the hearing. I don't.
Mr. Johnson, if I can ask a follow-up question about that, because I was looking at the issue of the trial judge's conduct, and I just wanted to get clarification. When I looked back at the cases, I think it was the Pratt case, the Truxell versus State case, they both suggest to me that we have de novo review and first look at whether a reasonable examiner would question this judge's ability to be impartial. And so one of my questions was, okay, it's de novo review, but here we have findings, admittedly on this question sparse, as you suggest, by the district, by the post-conviction court. How do we balance those two? Is it de novo review, or is it de novo review accepting the facts as found by the post-conviction court?
I would suggest, Your Honor, that it is de novo review, but the court should not be blind. You know, lower court findings or reasoning perhaps they have persuasive value, but it is de novo review under my reading of the case law.
Thank you. Any other questions from the panel? Any further comments, Mr. Johnson?
I don't, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. You have additional time for rebuttal. Mr. Griffin.
Good morning, Your Honor. Can everyone hear me? I'm seeing nods, but I don't hear anything in return.
Yes, we hear you.
Okay, thank you. May it please the court, counsel, good morning. My name is Mark Griffin. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I'm representing the state. What I'd like to begin with, I just have three main points, and then I'm happy to address any questions that the court has. Point number one, I disagree with counsel. This case, the evidence in this case was absolutely overwhelming, and the court, some of your questions have already indicated that. The state proved and the appellant admitted that he was driving the white truck. The state proved and the appellant admitted that truck hit the victim's Camaro. The state proved and the defense did not contest that that collision caused the victim's death. The state proved and the defense did not contest that he had meth in his system when the collision occurred. So this is not, I would submit, a close case in terms of the evidence. It's an overwhelming case. Point two, most of the errors that are raised on appeal, including most of the prosecutorial misconduct ones, were unobjected to. And I think it's important to remember that the basic rule in Minnesota is that if you don't object, it's waived at the appellate level. If the defense attorney in the trial, who knows the case and knows the evidence, doesn't think that a certain statement or piece of evidence is worth an objection, then I think that's relevant to this court's analysis on appeal as to whether or not it actually contains any prejudicial error. The most significant non-objection was the jury question. That was the, and I'm happy to answer more questions about that, but the any time a judge deviates from the the standard pattern jury instructions, it raises issues about the process and about fairness.
Mr. Griffin, if I may, and I understand what you're saying, and most of these were unobjected to, but getting to the jury instruction, just reading State versus Woodward, doesn't that just say we have to get to the prejudice question? Or as your position, and I don't think this was fleshed out, and it was just a recent case that, well, it may have been plain error today, but that case came down in 2020, which is several years after this trial. So could you just address that for me?
Absolutely. The Woodward was a recent case, and I understand that any time a jury instruction issue comes up, even if it's not objected to, because it's such a fundamental part of a constitutional process, that I believe looking at the three Minnesota Supreme Court cases, Woodard, Davis, and Pertine, I think that you have to apply a plain error analysis to that because it's such a significant part of the trial. Now, when you do so, however, in this case, and I brought that up just because I wanted to note that the defense attorney didn't object at the time, and the failing to object to a piece of evidence, it's not just a procedural box that we check off before we get to the griller factors. It means something. If the defense,
Mr. Griffin, before you move ahead, could I ask one just follow-up question? So, and I asked this of Mr. Johnson too. So in the Woodward case, they phrased that prejudice question as no rational jury would have acquitted the defendant of a more serious charge. I mean, do you see that as basically the same as kind of the third part of the plain error test on doesn't affect the appellant's substantial rights? I mean, do you see that as any different? Because it's phrased differently.
It is phrased differently, but based on the analysis that the court has, one of the things that you look at even under Woodward is the strength of the state's case. And yes, so they're given two different offenses to consider. But there's no indication in this record, and I think under the case law, that referring to one before the other or referring to both of them the way Judge Quaintance did would point the jury in one direction or the other. You're not going to consider this one. And Judge Meyer found this, actually. She noted this. I had the page written down, but I can't find it at the moment, that there was no indication that she found that the jurors were dissuaded from looking at both of the submitted offenses. So in terms of the defendant of the accused being able to put his theory of the case before the jury, the record doesn't show that he was deprived of that in any way by Judge Quaintance's instructions. Did I answer your question? Or close enough? Okay, thank you, Your Honor. The last of my 3 points is that reviewing the record in its entirety, the defense got to make the case that they wanted to make. None of the alleged errors, whether the judicial misconduct, the prosecutorial misconduct, the jury instruction question, none of those in any way deprived the defense of making its case. They were allowed to argue, really they argued two things. They argued the specific location of the collision, and they argued that the presence of meth in the appellant's system, there was no evidence that it had any impact on his driving conduct. And from that, that's where they got their argument that the defendant was not driving negligently. Well, they were able to put that in front of the jury. The evidence, unfortunately for the defense, simply didn't support that theory whatsoever. And I went at some length about that in my brief, especially about the location of the collision. But none of the errors that are alleged in appellant's case in any way deprived the accused of his right to put on the case to the jury that he wanted to put on. And the jury rejected it. The jury looked at the evidence, which I contend was overwhelming, and they convicted the appellant because of the evidence, not because of the errors, whether they were errors by the prosecutor or errors by the judge. Yes, Your Honor. So,
Mr. Griffin, if I may, I just wanted to ask you about the standard of review on the judicial misconduct question, the same as I did, Mr. Johnson. So the way, as I said to appellant's counsel, we start with the presumption that the trial judges act in an unbiased manner. But then when someone raises this issue, would you agree it's our de novo review about whether a reasonable examiner would question this judge's ability to be impartial? Would you agree that that's the way we should frame the analysis?
Your Honor, I do. And I was looking at that issue and I reread, it's Minnesota Statute 590.04, of course, is the post-conviction statute. And in there, it says the post-conviction review is de novo. I know we've got a post-conviction hearing and all these findings done by Judge Meyer that the court can rely on. But I do think that the way this appeal is postured, that this court would take a look at the entire record and exercise your judgment on the trial record and also on the review of Judge Meyer's findings and conclusions. Yes, I think it's de novo.
Thank you.
The issue of the jury instruction, I wanted to get back to that just briefly. As I noted before, that was not objected to. And what I would like this court, since you're doing a de novo review of the entire record, I would like the court, or I ask this court, when you're deliberating on this, to consider whether or not trial counsel actually waived this issue. And it's for this reason. When you read the entire transcript from the start of the case to the end, the defense, as I said, they contested two things. They contested location of the collision, and they contested whether or not there was any objective evidence that the meth affected the driving conduct. And they got to make that argument. The defense asked for a lesser included instruction of fourth degree DWI, which is driving a motor vehicle while in control, or driving a motor vehicle while under the influence of a controlled substance, in this case, meth. The state, of course, never had to prove any causal nexus between the presence of the drugs and the actual driving conduct. But the defense argued that vociferously throughout the case. There was really strong cross-examination of the state trooper witnesses about whether or not they observed any sort of meth-based conduct in the appellant. The defense stressed that other witnesses didn't see him swerving, they didn't see him speeding, he used his blinker when he changed lanes. So they contested this a lot. And they got to the end of the case and the defense asked for a lesser included jury instruction. The first time the jury heard about it was from the prosecutor in his closing. The defense then got up on his rebuttal and never mentioned it. And I know I brought this up in my brief as well. And the reason that I'm asking this court to consider whether or not it's waiver is this. The instruction, the second lesser included instruction, was antithetical to the defense theory during the entire case. They were disputing that the appellant was under the influence of meth. Then during closing, he doesn't mention it. My point is that the bedrock principle in Minnesota law is if you don't object, it's waived on appeal, or you're waiving that issue. Yes, I think that what happened here is that the defense made their motion for the lesser at the start of the trial. They got the instruction at the end, but then decided that they didn't want to argue that position anyway, because they'd been arguing against it during the entire trial. I think that defense trial counsel's conduct, the way he argued his case on closing, shows that he actually waived this issue at the trial level. And since you can now review this de novo from the actual trial level itself, I would submit to this court that really what this was is a waiver of the lesser included jury instruction issue by the trial attorney's conduct. I thought I saw someone about to answer a question. That's really the extent of everything I have. Unless there are any other questions that the court has, I would just once again stress the overwhelming nature of the evidence in this case. It was tremendous. And I would also like to stress, just in a global sense, when you pull back and you look at the entirety of these proceedings, did this accused person receive fair process? Did they get a fair trial? And I think when you look at everything, the entire record, the answer to that is unequivocally yes, the appellant did receive a fair trial. Therefore, I would ask that you deny the appellant's requested relief. I would say at this point, just for the record, as I noted in the brief, the state is not contesting issue 5, the the length of the conditional release. They're right on that one. But aside from that issue, I would ask that you deny the appellant's requested relief and affirm his conviction. Thank you.
Any questions from the panel? Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Mr. Johnson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'll be brief. I do part ways with counsel with regard to the waiver issue, specifically, and again, the court's not bound by this finding, but in Judge Meyer's order, concluded that the appellant's counsel at trial appeared to concede the existence of the fourth degree DWI driving with the presence of methamphetamine in his blood. It's not as if he was arguing against that. She made a specific finding that he appeared to concede that point, which would be reasonable under the circumstances when you have a criminal vehicular homicide with an attendant 48-month prison commitment for three DWI. It would be a sound trial strategy in that instance not to go for a grand slam, but to try and, you know, cause a jury to split their verdict, pick the client on the lesser included offense. And to that point, under the Woodward standard, if the test ultimately is that no rational jury could acquit the defendant, it's curious that we would have the existence of the lesser included offense at all at that point, because the basic premise to allow for that requires the district court, with due regard for the evidence at trial, to make a conclusion that there is a rational basis with the defendant on the greater offense and convict the defendant on the lesser offense. And so we have that inherent in the existence of the lesser included offense instruction itself. And contrary to counsel's point that the district court, or the jury rather, was able to weigh and consider the different elements of the two offenses, the post-conviction court, I'm just going to quote from this portion of it, came to the conclusion that the general instructions were given, but because no verdict was returned as to the lesser included offense, the jurors clearly followed the explicit indication they only needed to consider the lesser offense. They found petitioner not guilty of the greater offense. And I would suggest that that's a compelling finding. And the conclusion of law to be drawn from that is that the jurors simply were not ever tasked with considering the lesser included offense, and in fact did not. Of course, we have no view into the deliberation room, but it seems reasonable to conclude, and the evidence seems overwhelming, that the jury never had the opportunity to consider, weigh, and balance the two offenses in contact. I just wanted to make those final points. I would advocate against a waiver theory. That's why we have plain error review. We start chipping away at that and consider waivers based on trial counsel's conduct. It eventually will erode the plain error review standard. And so I would caution the court against considering a waiver in this case, or to consider that issue in context. Thank you.
Well, thank you both very much for the arguments. The matter was very well briefed. We thank you for the briefing and the arguments. We take the matter under advisement and we'll issue a decision within the statutory time period. Thank you both.